Hello and welcome to our first live edition of Media Talk from the Edinburgh International Television Festival. This year, instead of sniping from the sidelines, we're in the main room in front of a very large audience. If that wasn't bad enough, we're streaming this live on the Media Guardian website. So as Davina McCall would say, please don't swear. With me to pick over the highlights of this year's festival is the most distinguished panel that we could raise for 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning. Tim Hinks is the executive chairman of the TV festival and runs the Big Brother producer Endemol. Well, how on earth are we going to describe your company now that Big Brother's been axed?
Chilling and authoritarian.
Yeah, we could do that. Daisy Goodwin calls herself head girl of Silver River Productions. Can we rely on you, therefore, to keep us in line, Daisy?
You're lucky. Yeah.
Emily Bell is director of digital content at The Guardian, and she's a Media Talk regular, of course. How's your hangover, Emily?
It's live on the internet, apparently, mate.
It is. We'll be coming to you, our audience, during the show for comments and questions. You can put your hand up in the old traditional old media format and we'll bring a microphone to you, or you can text here using the pad on your armrests. And for the digitally savvy among you, including if you're watching online, you can tweet your comments. Please use the hashtag MediaTalkLive and they'll appear on the big screen behind us. Now the big story this year came from the big speech, the James McTaggart Memorial Lecture, delivered this year by James Murdoch, who's the chairman and chief executive of News Corporation in Europe and Asia, and he didn't mince his words.
When we gather as an industry, it's natural for us to talk about the future. But I'd like to do something different tonight, to turn our focus firmly to the present. Because the path we are already on is a dangerous one. How do the authorities currently approach intervening in and regulating the media industries? With relish is the answer. In the past 5 years, Ofcom launched nearly 450 consultations, nearly two every week. It has produced three public service broadcasting annual reports and two public service broadcasting reviews in five phases. These alone have in total, including appendices, special reports, and other related material, amounted to over 5,000 pages and spawned another 18,000 pages of responses. There's a land grab, pure and simple, going on, and in the interests of a free society, it should be sternly resisted. The land grab is spearheaded by the BBC. The scale and scope of its current activities and future ambitions is chilling. There's an inescapable conclusion that we must reach if we are to have a better society. The only reliable, durable, and perpetual guarantor of independence is profit.
Scary stuff. Well, we'll get our panel's reaction to all of that in a moment. First, the audience at the McEwan Hall here in Edinburgh included some of the biggest names in the television industry. Let's hear what they had to say.
It was a typical free marketeer speech, which is what you'd expect from James.
Absolutely breathtaking. I thought Gordon Gekko had come back from the grave, to be honest.
Jane Abbott, head of BBC Vision. I don't think an untrammeled, a sort of a market-led approach is actually proven in terms of whether he creates original production, for example, nor even news, because I would note that BBC News is very, very trusted by the public, and he didn't give any credit for that.
Alan Musbridge, editor of The Guardian. I agree with some bits of his talk about the BBC. I think the BBC is in some respects too large. He was really arguing for an Americanization of the British media with little or no BBC and little or no regulation, and arguing that the free market was the solution to everything. But if you look at America, the American media, particularly newspapers, for which he held up as an excuse, are a complete wreck.
I also question his view that somehow the American model for news provision is really healthy, because it isn't. The newspapers are an absolute crisis in the States. The idea that somehow the removal of the BBC from the news area and arena would somehow solve the business model problem of, let's say, newspapers is a highly questionable one.
My name is Maggie Brown, and I write about the media for The Guardian. It's certainly provoking a lot of discussion. There was very little of concrete fact or concrete policy suggestion in the speech. to actually hang, to really get a proper debate going. Are we really not going to have any Ofcom, any regulation in the future? We're just going to have one big media market. Do we want a federal communications agency as they have in America? Are we really, is he really suggesting that we don't want the BBC in this country? Of course we do.
Maggie Brown. Emily, what did you make of it?
I don't know, it's an interesting A-level economics essay, I thought.
A-level?
Well, you know, it was that thing about, that bollocks about profit. I mean, it's just not true, is it? Independence is guaranteed by profit. I think it's quite clever, because my theory about it is that it's actually about rallying support behind the BBC. Because the thing that Sky doesn't want at the moment is...
sorry, hang on a second. You're saying that it was designed to rally support for
this
the BBC?
This is my theory.
Okay, right.
I was, however, singing around the piano at 2:30 a.m, so I can't, and I can't sing.
We'll come to that in a minute.
But, so my theory is that what suits Sky is a strong BBC and Sky being the kind of commercial balance. And actually, the kind of the other players in the free-to-air commercial sort of market don't help Sky at all.
Don't ask for support on this one, Emily.
No,
you've
I'm not.
Completely off.
and so actually, there's nothing is guaranteed to get backbench MPs, you know, squeaky bum time in the House of Commons and a Murdoch savaging the news output of the BBC. It was like a pantomime. Boo, hiss, profit.
He did look very scary, didn't he, Tim?
I've got a media crush on him, though.
Oh, you've got a media crush? Why?
Tim was saying it's like electric delivery. makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up,
It was extraordinary. No, I thought it was exactly what you want from McTaggart, just talking about in the context of the festival.
Says the man who booked him.
I stand by my decision to book him. No, look, when we booked him, you know, for what it's worth, obviously the hope was that there would be a McTaggart that people would talk about, that would make everyone sit up and listen, that would divide the hall, maybe 1% for and 99% against, but nonetheless, that is a division. I think the only flaw in Emily's rather brilliant deconstruction that is in fact is aimed to make a strong BBC is that I think the real question now is, does the BBC in particular have the advocates and friends who can go out there and make the case for it? Because I think there is now something of a perfect storm gathering over the BBC. I think we can all pick holes in that speech, but in the end it was powerful. And everyone's taking it seriously. And now the question is, can the BBC respond strongly and in a way that's credible? And I think that's the challenge for them.
It was a bit odd that the response, there was an instant response from the Trust, but actually, you know, there's been no official kind of bam straight back, which is
I think that's right. And they haven't tackled it head on. And it's not as if what he said was surprising.
I mean, Daisy, you're a programme maker. Would it be good for you if the BBC was cut down to size?
Not at all. I mean, I'm a big fan of the BBC. I don't find the BBC's reach chilling at all. I find the whole thing a sort of part of the whole 80s revival that's going on, you know, ashes to ashes, kind of neon brights, miniskirts, and then you've got this kind of big free marketeer. There's a Thatcher-esque kind of flavour to it that... that's rather kind of nostalgic, actually. It reminded me of my youth. From my point of view, I want a strong BBC because I think the BBC does kind of lift the, kind of raise the bar for the rest of the industry. And my husband works in American for the American network in American News, and all I can say is the free market there has just savaged the American News network. So, you know. Well, the guarantee of a better society is the phrase that I like.
So what struck me as well was delivery. You know, he was very automaton.
Somebody told me, and I might not be allowed to repeat this, but it's all right because nobody's watching, frankly, is that it says so at various points in his script, take a drink.
Yeah, it's so it. So apparently, people who are at the front... we're able to see his auto cue because if you didn't see the speech, he drank after pretty much every paragraph, and there were six glasses of water lined up, so he wouldn't actually have to pour.
Drink from the same one twice. Is it like Prince? You know how Prince Charles has all his eggs boiled to like what's it? So he takes the top of them and he goes, I'll have that one.
I must say,
I think it's like that with James Murdoch's never drank out the same glass twice.
I must say, it's always refreshing that the Guardian takes the bigger picture on these things.
Sorry. Yes. The thing about James Murdoch is he's very clever, and he has done.
And he's powerful.
And he's very powerful, and he's done a really actually. I think personally, he's done a remarkable job with Sky. You know, he's done a couple of things that have absolutely sort of transformed it in terms of, you know, broadband package, blah, 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 all very boring, etc.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, this was a big idea, and the BBC is too big is actually a meme that most people, apart from Daisy, actually agree with a bit.
Yeah, I mean, Tim, pretty much everyone I agreed with that bit of it, didn't they?
Yeah, I think that's what's really refreshing and interesting is that when, particularly in the post-McTaggart, the discussion the next day, analysing the speech with him, the audience were asked, for instance, you know, is it over-regulated? You know, is the sector over-regulated? And there was a big majority saying yes. And I must say, I felt rather good about that, because what you don't want to do in reaction to this speech is for us all to look rather naive, sort of like we're all part of some liberal consensus and, gosh, the free market is terribly dangerous and so
I
on.
I want to look like that.
And, well, I know you do, Emily. But actually, we're all more sophisticated than that as an industry, and it was good to see that, you know, we weren't Pop just standing back part of it. The other thing is, you know, it is important, as you say, Emily, that this man has power. And that's that I thought was what was interesting about it, because at the end of the day, you can to hear him speak, I mean, he can do stuff. And when he said about BBC Online, you know, it needs dealing with, I mean, that's a kind of, you know, you think,
But actually, and let's come back to it, what this speech was actually about was charging for newspaper websites.
Yeah. Well, yes.
It's bizarre for me to come to a TV festival where everybody is talking about charging for newspaper websites.
What's it got to do with them?
What's it got to do with them? It's like me going, oh, can I just, you know, here's my script for next autumn's drama. It's like, I don't know, what do they know about it? But no, it is, you know, Rupert Murdoch's big thing at the moment is charging for newspaper websites. So what he was doing was he was carrying forth the big News Corp, the News Corp's big worldwide campaign at the moment, everything put behind the paper.
Are you going to charge for the Guardian's website?
No, it's a stupid idea.
Right, let's have a look at some of the comments that people have been tweeting. It's very exciting. This. Paul, real people, Paul Anstey says, first time I have seen James Murdoch, he looks like a weasel. BBC Osric Fool says BBC News is awful. How can that be competition? Joe Bolzano says the feed is very jittery, virtually unwatchable. Jem Stone though says watching Media Talk live just like real telly. Excellent.
He must be on the BBC's broadband.
Any questions or comments from our vast audience?
Yes, both of you.
Put your hands up if you have something to say.
My name's Dennis Mooney. I just wanted to ask Tim and Emily if they could perhaps develop a bit the notion that the BBC is too big. Specifically, what is it you want to be done, or what do you want the BBC to do that would make it the right size for you?
Tim, what would you cut from the BBC?
Well, I was quite careful to not say I was going to cut anything. The point I was making was that it seems to me incredibly important how the BBC stands and defends itself clearly and properly. I'm a big supporter of the BBC, like I think everyone on this panel. And the task now is to come back to James and make a clear and strong case for them. I think when you look at that, I don't know if you saw James held up a diagram, if you like, of all the interests the BBC has and all the areas it's in and Lonely Planet and so on, it's pretty clear to everyone watching, and by the way, I don't think that was the first time we had this thought, I think we've been feeling it for some time, that it appears to be trying to do too many things for too many people, and it's got to start reining itself back. I must say, I think if the BBC Trust wants to make a real statement, line in the sand, and start to turn the political argument on its head and win, if you like, it does need, to be crude about it, to start closing something down. It needs to do something to make it look like it has the BBC interests at heart. And I think a bit of tough love is needed from them, because at the moment we're not getting anywhere.
I think the smart thing to do is to get rid of all channels, effectively, apart from BBC One, BBC Two, and move to iPlayer, kind of, you know, because actually the thrilling project at the moment the BBC is digitising the archive and on demand, and actually that's the future. So politically, you could make the BBC immediately smaller by getting rid of all but its two main broadcast outlets.
Oh, I don't agree. Why?
And shift to, well, because
so
actually...
They halve it. So I'd rather get rid of, you know, a load of, you know, worldwide or something rather than get rid of two of the channels. Because, I mean, people... You know, that's what you buy into.
I never thought of you being slightly to the right of James Murdoch.
Very exciting that we've gone into triple figures on Ustream. We have 101 viewers, which is extremely, which is great.
Blimey.
Are they looking for porn? Are they
You've got a very big family, Matt.
We'll be very, very disappointed if they
This is a very specialist market.
Shall I cross my legs?
cross your legs, please. Yeah. Can we put Fox News behind a paywall so it fails and nobody sees it like charging for newspapers will? Roddick says, I'm very glad that I'm not the only person who thought Murdoch's speech was part of an 80s revival. And Beppa says, Media Talk Live, ooh, this is better than The Archers.
Do you know, it
also
really
says, love you, Matt. Great. This could go
You're
so many
blushing.
Ways. Thank you very much to the panel for now. There's a good deal more on James Murdoch and the speech, including the whole lot on video, actually, if you can stomach the entire thing, if you could bear it, on mediaguardian.co.uk. This is Media Talk Live from the Edinburgh International Television Festival coming up. We've got an interview with David Simon, the creator of the cult US cop show and Media Guardian favourite, The Wire. But first, let's take a whiz through some of the other big news stories from the weekend at the festival. One of the stories that came out from the interviews with the channel controllers was a line from the BBC One boss, Jay Hunt. Emily, she had something to say about media coverage of women.
Yes, she did. I wasn't in her session, but she picked up on, I think Martha Carney asked her about how do you feel about being sort of essentially monstered in the Daily Mail, which had the headline, Thin-Lipped Kitten Killer, which is great. I would like that, actually, on my, you know, gravestone. It's not true. She made a serious point. She said it's so off. It actually makes me think, you know, this is very off-putting for women who get this kind of treatment in a way that, you know, it's all about, you know,
how they look
yeah. And it's
I think what's interesting now is that why would anyone want to be a channel controller, male or female, because actually what happens is you are treated like a C-list celebrity or a sort of minor or an MP, in the sense that everything, your expenses are
online.
Well,
if you're a channel controller of a BBC channel, you are a bit like an MP because you're
stewarding
public money.
I don't know that any of the current channel controllers went into television thinking that their private lives would be there for scrutiny, that they would be pat, that their, you know, dustbins would be gone through and whatever. I'm not sure that's what they signed up for. They're all people who, you know, wanted to make TV programmes. They're not elected, let's face it. I think they went for Jay in a way that I was astonished by. And I don't know. I mean, yeah, women are bigger targets. I mean, you know, they're women who don't get that kind of treatment and women who do. Mm. And I think it's shocking, actually. And I'm afraid the Daily Mail has quite a lot to answer.
Right. I'm completely with Kirsty Allsop on this one from the Twitter crowd. He's been trying to doorstep Paul Dacre on his portrayal of women.
Well, we'll see how that goes. Another highlight was the lecture given by Robert Peston, the BBC's business editor, who he delivered it so quickly I thought his head was going to explode, Emily. He added his voices to those who said it's inevitable, indeed essential, for news organisations to start charging online. Emily, you're the only one. You're the only person fighting for free.
No, I'm not the only one, actually. Do you know what? Everybody who says, they're going to charge online, almost without exception, they're blokes who have no experience of running anything on the internet. Ariane Huffington said, charging for content online is madness. Vivian Schiller, who a very smart woman, used to be VP at the New York Times, now runs NPR in the States, said the industry is gripped with a collective delusion. So the women who actually know something about this say it's mad. I mean, nobody really thinks it's a good idea.
The WSJ is the only thing that's worked.
The Wall Street Journal.
Yes, and it doesn't work. You know, the Wall Street Journal's paywall does not generate enough revenue to run, if you like, to make up sort of the deficit, which is why, before the ad recession sort of started looming, Murdoch was actually going to remove the paywall. Mm. And why he's pre-announced this move a year ahead is to try and get everybody else to do it. But Rupert Murdoch hasn't got a track record in anything online.
Tim, you were within earshot at the official McTaggart dinner when there was a stand-up row between Peston and James Murdoch. What happened?
Well, obviously, Chatham House rules, you know?
Certainly not.
But seeing as it's just here and amongst friends, and the internet and everything. I think they've gone on record now saying they had a healthy and vigorous exchange of views.
It was in the Observer.
Observer?
Yes, the F word.
I was sitting next to Robert Peston, who was great company. He was pretty vociferous about and defending the BBC, going back to what we were saying earlier. He would seem to be a pretty strong advocate. One or two...
table banging? So table banging.
There was table
How
banging.
How dare you talk to me like that?
There was the F word. It was pretty exciting. This is
what happens when.
It's very virile. But it's been a very, very virile festival.
It's straight mental.
That's the thing. That's too many straight men. It's often been said.
That's really true. Listen. There are links. Shut up. There are links to all these. There are links to all of these stories on guardian.co.uk/mediatalk, where you can also sign up to this very fine podcast every week.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
Now, as we all know, Media Guardian has its own pet obsessions. There was a time when it was Big Brother, Tim. Sadly, that time's passed.
I can talk about that if you want.
The mantle has passed to The Wire, which is a cult US cop show that's watched by almost as many people as watch this podcast. Its creator, David Simon, was at the festival, and he was here to talk to The Guardian columnist Charlie Brooker. Here's part of his inspiring session.
It feels in a way that a lot of your work has an almost sort of bloody-minded aversion to adopting the usual sort of shorthand.
Well, I think television as a medium, in terms of being literate and telling stories, I think it's shortchanged itself from its inception. And I think that's because of advertising. It was an advertising medium, and only when television managed to liberate itself from the economic construct of advertising was there a real emancipation of story. American television, up until the point of premium cable, was about the interruptions every 13 minutes to sell you cars and iPods and jeans and whatever else. That was the point of the show, not the shit they put around the ads. The ads were the point. And so you had to bring the most number of eyeballs to that show. And that meant dumbing it down, making the plot simple, gratifying people by the end of the hour. More tits, more ass, more stuff that blows up. That was television. So as a storyteller, you can't do anything serious. And since my impulse is journalistic, at least, it's to argue what I think is true or not true about the world, how would I make a living doing that and take myself seriously, or even half seriously? There's no way to do it. Once it became, here's 58 minutes, and we're not going to interrupt it to sell any shit, the only thing we're selling is story, that's a place where I can actually, stand and do something that matters, to me anyway. And that's a relatively new situation. But it is true. Listen, I don't need everybody to watch. If you want to do your laundry and watch The Wire and leave the room and carry on a conversation or whatever, I'm going to lose you. And I did lose those people, and I probably didn't get a lot of them back. And it was okay. HBO didn't need to put the maximum number of eyeballs in every story. Their economic model is, if certain shows bring people into our tent to pay $17.95 a month, okay, then we can fund that show. And The Wire brought some people to HBO, and some people who were subscribers didn't dig it, and they watched The Sopranos, and other people watched boxing, and other people watched Sex and the City. But as long as they stayed in the tent, so in effect, the ratings no longer mattered as much. The Nielsens were emasculated as a force.
Did you ever have pressure? Because the ratings were sort of consistently relatively low, weren't they, throughout the?
No. And what happened was, eventually, the DVD concept, which didn't exist when we were planning The Wire, caught up to the show. And so our ratings became even more and more meaningless with every season. By the end, I think we had our worst ratings the fifth season, and more people were watching the show. And it was easy to figure out what was happening. It wasn't appointment television anymore. It was, nobody was tuning in on the Sunday night to watch the premiere. They were getting it on demand. You could get it whenever you wanted just by downloading it, off of your HBO. Or they were waiting for the DVDs, or they were getting it illegally off of the BitTorrent sites on the web. And HBO knew this. They came to the conclusion that the ratings no longer mattered. The TV had become, at this level, a lending library. You went and you got the book you wanted and you read it when you wanted it. And that's liberating in its own way. But how you measure the impact of a show is no longer, it's kind of a hard thing to do.
Talking about impact of a show, what, if anything, are you hoping the viewer takes away?
Well, The Wire was a critique of unrestrained capitalism, which has been the predominant social policy in the West since Reagan and Thatcher. It's about what happens when maximized profit is mistaken for a framework on how to build a social just society. That was the critique. Now, I don't know that everyone's going to get that, or that it lands, or that, you know, for some people it's just a gangster story, or it's whether the cops will catch the bad guy. But for us, it was this is what went wrong in the West in the last part of the last century and in the beginning of this one. And we thought we had a fair critique when we started the show. In my country, Enron and WorldCom, and, you know, the first financial implosions were starting. But, you know, we did not anticipate the complete collapse of Wall Street. The extent to which Wall Street had bought into maximize short-term profits as its defining core value, you know, to the exclusion of all other sanity. I mean, we didn't anticipate that. That was in that same repertorial stance. That was a happy coincidence of sorts. But no, I mean, that's really what it's about. I'm not a Marxist. It's not. I'm glad we have capitalism in the toolbox to generate wealth. It's the only really effective means of generating mass wealth. But to mistake it as we have for, you know, at least the last 30 years as a framework for how to build a society and how you would think that you don't have to mitigate capitalistic forces to in some way incorporate all levels of society and give everybody a shared sense of purpose and vision in your society is just incredible to me. And it's led to just everything from the implosion on Wall Street to the ineffectiveness of government to solve a long-term problem. They can't solve the war on drugs. They can't fix the school system. Right now, we can't figure out national health care, something that this country did half a century ago, more than that. If you look at that, I mean, God knows how we're going to do on something really complicated like global warming. I mean, this is, you know, if there's no short-term profit in it, it ain't getting done.
Does everything you do have to have a message? Is that what you're primarily about?
Yeah. Or why do it? I mean, you know, they're giving you 10 or 12 hours commercial-free on HBO, and they're not getting in your way. They can. You get to say what you think is justified, and you get to find a way to say it. You know, and I'm using drama to do it. That's the tool in my toolbox.
David Simon, the creator of The Wire, talking to our own Charlie Brooker. Now, if you have just joined us online, hello. And a reminder that you can see the whole of this session, the whole of this podcast, in video, or if that's too scary, in audio as well, later on today. Now, an issue that's been rumbling along for a while is that of presenter pay, but it does now look as if things are coming to a head. One revelation from this festival is that the BBC may be forced to publish the salaries of its top stars if, as seems likely, the Tories get into power at the next election. Here's the Conservatives' broadcasting spokesman, Ed Vasey MP, being put on the spot here in Edinburgh by Nicky Campbell.
Will you make it law that the BBC has to reveal the salaries of its stars?
We want to make it happen. Whether you do that in a negotiation with the BBC Trust, whether you do that as part of the charter negotiations, legislation seems a pretty big hammer to crack this nut with. So there are a range of different options that are worth looking at. But we would like the BBC to publish their salaries.
The thing that really strikes me about all of this is that the TV industry seems to be just in collective denial. I mean, all the debate on this stage, on that panel, was all about, still about, why this shouldn't happen, Tim, not what the BBC is going to do when it does happen.
No, I couldn't agree more. I think if you have a situation where an MP is putting you on the spot about transparency and you're unable to answer it, you're in deep water, you're in a lot of trouble. And I think it's very clear to me, I was at that session, it was a very good session, but it was very clear to me that we're in a situation now where we cannot possibly avoid being absolutely open about what talent is paid. I suspect there are all sorts of legal and contractual complications about revealing previous deals or even current deals. I don't know about that. But I think going forward, we have to, because otherwise, the BBC in particular is going to look like, metaphorically, as it were, it's defending its duck house or whatever. You know, it's a ridiculous situation of not being transparent. And unfortunately, whatever the subtleties and complexities of the argument, the Conservatives or politicians in general will win the day, because they will be able to say, look, you don't trust the public. And there's no way of tackling that argument. You have to be transparent.
And this is what Jaina Bennett, you know, in a rather convoluted way, which is her want, said in her response. She was basically saying, although she denied it later, but she did say, in effect, that the reason that we shouldn't do this is because the public are not clever enough to, or well informed enough to take a view.
What she was saying is a subtle, you know, there are all sorts of subtle reasons why publishing is transparent. The fact is, it's public money. You know, that's the thing, it's public money. And I think it's a marketing issue for the BBC, and it's a PR issue, which is actually, you know, in order to rally kind of support and make themselves sort of closer to their audience, they have to do this. And you don't have to publish individual salaries, but you do have to publish salary bands and how many people are in them and what your top
paid people are. But there's a difference between executive salaries, isn't there, and talent salaries.
But is there?
No, I'm not sure there is, because it's all public money.
Yes, no, absolutely. But the talent thing is a really interesting question, because if they publish, is that going to, you know, I mean, as we all know, there are huge discrepancies within, you know, who gets what in the talent sector, which is, unlike the executives, you know, pretty much everybody knows, but, you know, there are shows where you've got two presenters doing the same job, getting, usually the woman getting half the salary. I mean, I think that's going to be a fascinating kind of revelation about who gets what and what it will do to the whole. I mean, I'm all for it. I think it will be gripping, actually. Yeah, it'll be the most interesting bit of...
Well, a fantastic story for us.
Yeah, it's the best story ever, but also I think pretty healthy in a funny way. What do you think it will do to the power of agents? I think that will be...
To the power of agents?
Yeah, I mean...
Hopefully it'll be great for them, because we love them. So. I think that is, you know, the consequences of it. Will they go up? Will they go down? Who knows? Yeah. But in the end, it's undeniable. And I don't think there is a distinction between talent and executives. If you look at it from the point of view, as you said, that it's public money and they're all on the payroll, and we need to know what they're being paid.
What does the audience think? Let's have the house lights up. And
are they awake?
Well, I think they are.
So they've gone a bit quiet.
Very lively.
any views from the audience on talent pay? Do we want to see talent pay published? What will happen when it is? Could you stand up so we can see you? Thanks very much. Say who you are.
David Croft from the National Film and Television School. A couple of things from that debate. Peter Fincham revealed that the BBC bid for Jonathan Ross was in fact the lowest, which I found amazing, and seemed another example of how the BBC handled that whole situation rather badly. because of course the BBC had been demonised because of that contract.
Yeah.
Secondly,
I mean, if it's certainly true, isn't it? If Jonathan Ross hadn't been in that studio with Russell Brand, that story wouldn't have gone stratospheric in the way that it did. It was about Jonathan Ross. Not
it was
Russell
about
Brand.
Jonathan Ross's salary as much.
It is about his salary, yeah, absolutely.
Secondly, yes, I'm in favour of seeing what the stars are paid. But also, when Nikki Campbell said to Envezi, "Well, okay, now you let's say the BBC publish." What are you going to do? Are you going to start imposing sanctions? Mm. He didn't know the answer, in fact looked really uncomfortable, and clearly hadn't thought through what the result of this, apart from perhaps some prurient enjoyment about seeing what people are being paid, they clearly hadn't sort of thought through what the consequences might be.
All right, we've got to wrap this up, but let's just take a few comments from Twitter. Jive Cork says, in Ireland, talent pay for our state broadcaster is published the year after. What about doing that? Chris Jones says, publishing salaries should force the BBC to adopt the Channel 4 model, develop talent rather than buy it in. Osric Fool, Beppa says, Charlie Brooker rocks, get him on your panel. Yes, thank you very much. And Paul Anstey says, Emily Bell rants are classic. She's crazy, but makes sense so often.
Wow. And you've literally just filed that.
Yeah, with my foot, actually, from there.
Listen, that is almost it for this Edinburgh special. So there's been a lot of weighty discussion in all the debates here at the festival and on this programme. But there's been plenty of laughs too.
The TV executives are maybe like frogs in hot water, not even realising the impending crisis and their own doom being brought steadily to the boil.
I didn't think about it at all, but I wore Marks and Spencer's boxing shorts. Boxers, rather, you know.
Have you got them free for the rest of my life?
They send it to me all the time.
I was at a West Brom game, and a guy came up to me when all the Fritzl stuff was going on, and he said to me, I'll say one thing for that Fritzl, he never touched them grandkid.
Yeah. Now I'm painting a nuclear family that doesn't exist in The Guardian, but you know, in the real world. Well, you really...
When we do a reality show, one thing it friggin' ain't, it's not art.
So I'm both proud and honoured to be paving the way for Anton Deck, who should be standing here tonight in 2018 if this trend continues.
It seems to me that your success is based on your friendship, that you know, you come across as great mates, and you know, it's not so much strictly comedy.
All right.
Thanks.
It's a letter about squirrel shooting. It's Marco Pierre White. It says, "Dear Mr. Pierre White, how the fuck would you like a bullet up your arse and to be served on a dinner table at a squirrel's feast, you wanker?"
I don't actually have an answer for that. That's very good. You're a pretty good journalist.
We've managed to get through the whole session without a fuck. And there it was. Sorry about that.
We usually manage that, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
Oh, you mean like the word?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
No, not the act. Well, even James Murdoch got a laugh. One laugh.
It was a laugh a minute, I thought.
It was Tim. Very good.
Before we go, let's get festival highlights. Daisy Goodwin.
Ooh, I enjoyed the compliance session with Frank Skinner and Jim.
I enjoyed the compliance session.
I enjoyed the compliance, that's good. That was rock and roll.
Okay, first real festival highlight was last night, 2:30 in the morning, Emily's version of the Gary Barlow song that I'd never heard before. That was
This lot were singing. I left. I didn't. I had not a single drop to drink.
Shall we hear
I
a
was
phrase
in bed at 12.
Now.
Come on.
Let's hear a little bit.
No, I can't sing. And actually, that was duping the editor of The Guardian. He's a brilliant pianist.
Can you play the piano?
Telling him that I want you back is a long lost Cold Porter classic.
Yes, it was very funny.
Tim, you were sadly absent last night.
I didn't make it last night, no. Although it sounds fantastic. the genuine highlight for me was, and this is a Media Garden exclusive, was hearing, I'm pretty sure this is what I heard, Christopher Biggins ordered room service. He was in the room next to me in my hotel, and he does it in exactly the same way as he does everything. So he was ordering a sort of whatever he's ordering, a glass of something and something to eat in the Biggins way. You know, it was absolutely extraordinary. So that is a highlight.
Thank you very much.
It's an absolute pleasure, man.
Thank you very much to our panel. That is it. I hope you've enjoyed it, whether you're watching online or here in the audience. Today's show has been such an effort that I'm going to have to take a month off. Actually, I'm on sabbatical. I'm on sabbatical. So we get sabbaticals at The Guardian.
No, I know. I've just finished one, but I don't remember.
It's all those auto trader profits, you see. You can do what you like. You know?
not really. Did you see how much we lost last year? So that's it. From all of us here in Edinburgh, thank you very much and goodbye.